dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X. This is the final stream for tonight, and I'm now here with the incredible charisma and intellectual genius that is Semi-Ogog. Hello, I said I was going to deliberately mispronounce his name. Semi-Ogog, how are you doing?
Yeah, it's better than Semi-Togod and Ogog, and yeah, I get all sorts. That's the worst name I ever picked. Yeah, but here I am, you know. Morgoth, for example, picked his name off the cuff, and I still think of him as a goth upon the moors, you know, so it works. Yes. But yeah, Semi-Ogog. Yes, I'm well, sir, and very happy to be here. I promise myself that before we jump into things, I'm going to try my two puns on you. You have a special pun gland. Okay, so you and Pale Hominid are I don't even know how your minds work. Okay, so here it is. You ready?
Okay.
I'm shocked you'd call him a monkey. After all, he's tailless. He's an ape. It's a gibbon.
Oh, yes. Very good. Very good. Yes.
Okay, all right. I have one more. I hesitate to admit it, but I often find myself becoming erect at funerals. Mourning wood.
That's not bad, actually. That's a good one. I appreciate that one. Very good.
I tried.
All right. So with all of that said, before we get into the topics, do you have anything to say about 2024? I tend to ask this with everyone, because I think it's, you know, this is obviously tied to time and place, and it's a social history that we're building up here. So is there anything that you'd like to say broadly about this year?
Yes, I got married, and so I had to negotiate a bride price in France, and I'm eating much better than I had ever expected I would in my life, but the price is a heavy one, as she is as she's French, and so as a result, yeah, I've been forced to think about many things in my life and to look at what I was and what I am now. In addition to being old now, I'm also married, and that puts me in an entirely different category. And so there's been a great deal of reflection. You know, I've been reflecting personally about what I am and have been and perhaps will be, which has been quite a bit of a transformation. Otherwise, there's the major thing of me being the eater of crow, as you can still read in the description below. And when Trump went down and I took upon that sobriquet, it seemed like he might be gone for good. And the idea of thinking that there was something more going on with him, that in fact, payback might be coming somewhere down the line. Well, it's possible that that I wasn't as wrong as I thought I was. I certainly was correct in thinking that there's much more to this than simply him going away. But it remains to be seen whether or not any of that, you know, amounts to anything really at all. It's premature to say that. And I certainly don't want to sign up for another big dish of crow. But that's another thing that I've been reflecting upon. You know, he did appear, he did come back, and there are some interesting things that are being arranged there that I'm still working my way through. Yes, technology has continued to sweep over everyone and shape and reshape people's behavior. There are some aspects of that perhaps we can get into. There's the way in which technology seems after a fashion, despite the fact that we read with it, it seems to be supplanting in some sense the more traditional processes of reading and certainly of learning about things. You touched upon a bit of this with the subject of research and how you are undertaking all sorts of more extensive research in work for your Substack. And there are things that are possible now that weren't possible before. You would think that it would be a great time to be a traditional writer, as it were, since you can self-publish, you can instantly publish, you can instantly correct your work. If you find a typo, you just log back in and fix it. But in some ways, it seems to me that the population itself is not so willing or interested in things that stay, that stand, that you read more carefully and digest visually. There's more of this sort of ephemeral thing of material kind of being pushed through. Also, over the past year with these life changes, what I used to be versus what I am now, without attempting to assert that there isn't some sort of consistency through that, there is a through line. You know, I'm not a schizophrenic, but well, I mean, I don't think I am, but, there is this whole idea of phases of life and things that you get into or that you get dragged down by or that, you know, pull you in or that you have to pursue in various phases of your life. And to some extent, for me at least, it seems that those things correspond to my patchwork of genetic heritage, almost as though I had to go through certain aspects of my genetic background during different phases of my life. And that's been something I've been thinking quite a bit about, particularly since I followed your stream with Ed Dutton. And he was talking about things like miscegenation and how sperm, for example, can be seen as an invading alien force that the woman's body would attempt to reject, and how the children of such unions, particularly something like a Bantu descended person and an Icelander, for example, as opposed to, I think his example was something like an Englishman and a Dane, would really be something like third cousins or second cousins or something. You know, as you get these different elements, they have to be accommodated somehow. And this can lead to physical differences. It seems to me that there would have to be sort of differences of the biospirit or the archetypes or the soul itself, certainly of differences that have to be accommodated in terms of being driven to one behavior or another, or one psychological outlook or another. So these are all things that I've been thinking about through the year. Otherwise, I'm just waiting for the next, 28, 29 days, hoping that someone doesn't touch off a nuclear explosion or something, or some insane way of just sort of knocking over the chessboard at this point. So let's cross our fingers and hope that it doesn't get a whole lot worse before it gets better.
Yeah, indeed. That's actually something that hasn't been discussed at all on Millennial, the threat of war with Russia. Interesting. We obviously have these topics that we discussed beforehand, before we went on air, and they're all interesting, and I wanted to talk about them. But as an option, would you like to talk about what you were saying earlier about this change in yourself and noting, like, comparing what you were with what you are now and all of that that has come with getting married? Because that is a very interesting thing in itself. Or yeah, is that too personal? I mean, if it's
no,
too...
I'd take any chance to publicly make fun of my wife and her being French. Yeah, yes, absolutely. No, it's not too personal, and it certainly can be discussed in ways that that, you know, don't compromise anything. Yeah, there are a certain number of life changes, certainly for someone who was as dissolute as I in my youth. The way, I don't know how to get into this. One way is to say that it's a joke I make fairly often that only recently have I become white. You know, for some reason, as you get older, your eyes lighten, and so my eyes have gone from a kind of a sort of very light brown, amber color with some darker brown spots to fully hazel with quite a bit of green that can be seen. They're almost like a dark olive green now. And that sort of reveals my whiteness beneath the Bomalian exterior. Also, I like to say that and I just invented this. It's a complete lie, but I like to say that in Scandinavia, white hair and blonde hair are both called blonde. And so as a result of getting old, you know, I can now say that I have blonde hair and green eyes. and another thing that has happened is that I very much like whiskey now, and I did not before. I mean, I drink it when I was out or whatever, but now I'm like, oh, this whiskey tastes fine. And so this is the whiteness that has come upon me. Also, I'm less inclined to chase women, or to succumb to whatever the manipulations are based on, desire. So some things that you could say are just, well, it's naturally a result of maturity. But, in my own life, I've been this, enough about me. What do you think about me? I have
former rake, it says there.
Ah, yes.
That's your own self-description. I didn't come up with this.
Yeah, once upon a time. I'm much better now. I'm feeling much better now, having been married. I've seen myself go through very distinct phases. Like my childhood photos, I really do have platinum blonde hair. And it's not just for the first, you know, 2 years. It's like up until I'm 6 or 7. And then around 8, it starts turning into what they call dirty blonde. Then somehow my hair goes to this sort of brown and then mouse brown and then turns this charcoal brown and then goes straight to charcoal and starts getting shot through. So I could show you a picture of myself in my early 20s and I look like a full-on guinea, you know.
You look absolutely. Would you say that was your Italian stallion phase?
Yes, exactly. Yes, I was indeed a stallion. And of course, that changed. And then I started to get this thing where my hair started turning white. I mean, my hair started turning white in my I first saw it when I was 20. My first, you know, gray hairs cropping up. And so you get this sort of Mediterranean gentleman thing like Ricardo Montalban or something, you know, where you get this white on the sides. But then that spread all over, and I aged out of being a med, and I'd like to think of myself as being an honorary Northwestern European. You know, I'm sure that many of the more pink-faced brothers from up that way would still look at me like, wogs begin at Calais. But it is a fact that I'm about a quarter German. Well, I'm a quarter German and a quarter English, and then about an eighth French. And that's likely from Northern France, not Mediterranean France. So there's some claim there to having a dominant amount. It just had to overcome an eighth Greek and a quarter Italian. And so I've seen these phases come through, and I've dated people in the past who are of mixed heritage, and you see this kind of clashing. There's a distinct kind of clashing in their character. Where they careen between these poles. In my case, I have this whole sort of Northwest European thing of, well, now you shouldn't become emotional about this. This is ridiculous, you know? And if you do become emotional about it, the last thing you should ever do is let someone see you getting emotional about it. Never, ever reveal that. However, throughout my life, I have very strong emotional reactions to things. I just don't show them. And so you smolder, like there's an inner wop and an outer wasp, you know, and the two create these conflicts, not least in communicating with people, you know, in relationships. I'd tell women, I'm like, just because I don't show emotions, what would make you think I don't have them? I'm not a sociopath, you know, it's just that I'm disgusted by the idea that you would allow them to control you or you would show them. But even that becomes kind of ridiculous because even though you don't show them, they are creating tensions. They are shaping your behavior. They cannot be easily digested. And I feel like in some ways over the years, maturity, insofar as I can claim it, which is dubious, is really the process of reconciling these parts of your character that create these conflicts, and you come to a state of peace with them, or it's a situation where the sharp edges have simply been ground off the where the gears meet through, you know, the inevitable vicissitudes of life. I had thought perhaps this would be something that would resonate with you to some degree, as I understand you have Italian background, but you just informed me it's such a small percentage that it really just means you like pizza.
Yeah, that's what we were saying before we went on air, that I am pizza enabled by 7% Italian DNA. Yeah, it used to be a sort of, I mean, it's ridiculous now, but even within like just a few years ago, it was a sort of conflict in me that I'm not wholly British, so I can't just say I'm British. So it was a bit of a bummer. It was like, it complicates things. But then you realize, well, there isn't that much difference anyway. And in any case, it's only 7%. So who cares? I mean, what difference does it actually make? And of course, I do wonder about this. Like, what is that 7% doing? Is that where I get my visual design flair from or not? Maybe it's got nothing to do with it. So this kind of stuff is quite difficult to quantify and extrapolate, work out what it's doing. But in any case, these European ethnicities, as I say, are very similar anyway. So I don't think it's something that, I think that people in our sphere who think about these things can overthink them very easily. In the end, you have to deal with the person you are, and reference to this or that ethnicity might have not that much. I mean, I think you should take reassurance from this or that ethnicity that is yours, but it might not be all that much of a guide in life because the different European ethnicities are so similar. They're so alike. So with Americans, you know, there's always this thing about the Euro mutt, which I think is a horrible phrase, because mutt, you know, dogs and all this. Not that I've got anything against dogs, you know, I like them, but it's a disparaging term. And, you know, as I say, in the end, you've just got to deal with the person that you are. And that's a challenge. About being emotional, I've always been very emotional. And it's only in the last few years that that's really calmed down after a sort of peak about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And I think that's age, I guess, like, you know, less crazy hormones and whatever. And I think most men are, I'm probably where most men are at the age of 20, 25, where their emotions are just under control most of the time. And I think that's really an essential part of being a man. You have to put things aside and think about the bigger picture. Because otherwise, I think women need this of us. They need us to be like this, because they're not like this.
Yeah, as a crisis response, yes. And certainly what you're saying can't be argued with. We, each of us, are individually, you know, manifest here in what we're in. You know, this is the only, you know, car for the ride. Nevertheless, and certainly the point is well taken about, you know, don't overthink that. But I mean, you're talking to me, so of course there's going to be this neurotic, you know, processing and reprocessing. But I nevertheless think that first of all, there does have to be, as I view things, and I can't view them any other way, there has to be a correspondence between the interior, the soul, the psyche, if you prefer, and what's out here, you know, as above, so below, or, you know, there is some truth to the cover of the book indicating what's in it. You know, let's not be dishonest about it. So in that respect, I would have to think that there are corresponding things. The other angle, though, is that as I've traveled across Europe to many places there, I found that I can understand things about the people that I visit, or the cultures, I should say, that I visit, and the people in those cultures with whom I interact. I can understand them based on when I have that. Germans, I get. Now, they'll look at me and they'll be like, well, maybe you are Slavian, but I'm not sure you're German at all, you know. But I understand them. And there are ways in which I am like them. I'm like, this shit needs to be clean. This is your workspace. You know, there can't be anything cluttered because you might need to do something in an emergency. I'm going to back my vehicle in case I have to go to the hospital in a hurry. I can drive straight out without screwing around. You know, there are these methodical things about how it should be done and how it shouldn't, you know. And when I go hang out with Greeks, I'm like, oh, yeah, that guy's going to try to rip me off. Yep, I can tell. That enabled me to some extent to be more successful in reading the cultural signs of a Turk, you know. The Italians, I can get why they want it to be sing-song and beautiful. Why you look at an English translation of Italian or French and it's just all this flowery excess. And that has its place, and I indulge in it, you know, with some of my poetry. But by the same token, I love the way that there is this English ideal of absolute clarity in writing to, like, remove all the nonsense. Not that I've achieved that ideal. But I read people who have, and I'm like, damn, now that is it. That is it. It's elegant simplicity. Less is more. There's nothing in the way. And so it's not just this aspect of reflecting and thinking to myself, you know, how these things might be active within me. It's carried forward into my interactions out in the world with the various cultures I interact with. For example, I just don't understand Slavs, you know. In order to understand Slavs, the only ones I can understand are South Slavs. They don't have quite the nasal speech, and they get drunk in warm weather, you know, rather than, you know, sliding around on a frozen river. And so I think something about, you know, that area of the Balkans being sandwiched between Italy and Greece means I have a way to interact with them. But Poles, for example, I'm just like, huh? You know, I have no background there to help me understand it.
Somebody has said in the live chat, we Europeans, whites, are such a small, embattled genetic group that we can ill afford petty tribal differences to turn us against each other. I completely agree. I couldn't agree more. And I think it's extremely important that when we talk about things like this, we don't turn it into some sort of dick measuring contest or anything like that. This should be a matter of curiosity. Because I think it is interesting and it's worth talking about. It's worth thinking about. The nature of millennial is that it is international. It's all these different countries. I could show again the graph of that. And that is a crucial part of this. Hold on a second. Here it is. This is millennial this year. As you can see, I have no interest in creating division between different peoples, obviously, just to underline that. You are, let me get this again, a quarter German, a quarter Italian, a quarter English, and then the final quarter is an eighth Greek and an eighth...
French. Yes.
Okay. That it is, you know, it with America, there are these astonishing mixes. You know, to someone in a European country, that is quite an amazing mix of different things. That's what, five different ethnicities. But in America, this kind of thing is very typical, especially now. It gets more and more. Each generation, it's more and more. So someone with eight ethnicities will... have kids with someone else who has eight different ethnicities, and then their kids have 16, and it's kind of amazing. But even somebody like, for example, Michelle Pfeiffer, I happen to be quite familiar with her ethnic makeup, having looked her up before on ethnicelebs.com. She's German, one quarter Swiss German, one quarter Swedish. Distant English, Welsh, French, Dutch, and Irish.
So she's primarily Germanic. Those are all Germanic groups.
Yes, that's true. But still, it's quite an astonishing mix. So this kind of thing has just happened in America. And I don't know... you know, if I were writing history, if I could author this, I wouldn't have that happen because I think it's just too risky. You're asking for complications. But on the other hand, this is ethnogenesis. This is how it happens. There is the funneling of ingredients into a place, and then they meld, and something new emerges from that. And of course, there's also the reverse flow where somebody from America can go back and move to Europe and reintegrate, which I think is not difficult. I've known many Americans living in Scotland and England. So that happens as well. I don't know what to think about it. But in terms of characteristics, as I said, these different things, you're in the end, you're still yourself. Whatever you discover about your origins, you're still the person that you've always known. But then that in itself is always changing. That's a whole thing as well. And that's why it interested me when you said you were contemplating how you have changed over the years. Because people do constantly evolve. And the person, there's almost not much point trying to work out what you were like at 17 or something, because that person's gone. That person, for me, that's what, 25 years ago. That's a long time. Mm-hmm. And in the interim, many things have happened. I can't even really remember what I was like 10 years ago. I have to look at the videos. It's funny that's possible to do for people like us. We can actually see the video evidence of the person you were. But for most people, and I think this is a broader cultural point, for most people, this kind of thing was just forgotten. It just fell away into time. And this came up with my conversation with Ed Dutton, that goes for everything, really. So much used to just get forgotten, which is now preserved. And I'm not sure whether it should be. I'm sure you have some things to say about this.
Yes, I mean, as you get older, you begin to think to yourself, yeah, there's this author I really liked, and I heard he burned his papers, you know, shortly before he died, because there was a whole group of them he didn't want anyone to see. And now I'm like, yeah, there's probably going to be a box I need to label that way. So, you know, that to your point about whether or not something should be preserved. Of course, it's all, what's the line from Blade Runner, you know, tears in the rain. Nothing, you know, nothing really remains. Nothing remains round that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. There are aspects that disappear. I do want to say, in response to that super chat that came in, or the comment, this is certainly not about a dick measuring thing. Although I'm perfectly happy to make fun of some other European groups, I make fun of my wife for being French, and she deserves it. But I think it's more, it has to do with the reality of this ethnogenesis. You know, I am this ethnogenesis, whatever it is, certainly in terms of my family. And I think it's worth at least hypothesizing, though there are all sorts of aspects or ways in which this might not fit, you know, but, you know, speculate, hypothesize. I think it's worth considering the idea that the mix that is within you creates certain tensions. Now, that is not to say that someone with less of a mix wouldn't have those tensions as a result of more deeply buried things like this, or just the natural process of maturation and, you know, going through different things about oneself or resolving them. But I think it's something worth considering, because there are those tensions. You yourself said, if I were writing this script, you know, I probably wouldn't do this because there are certain risks involved with it. And I think this is useful to bring up, at least insofar as it's like, hey, here's maybe one risk that individuals would confront, how to balance these aspects of oneself. So I think
I think the answer to that is you have to look at yourself as you are, the person that you are, and think, what does he need? What's good for him? And let the present speak for itself, rather than try to analyze what the present should be based on these past ingredients, as much as you can do that. Maybe it's useful to look at the past. But someone said, the small, hold on, within ethnicities, there are subgroups as well. So there's no need to obsess about it too much. And this is true. Within, you know, you might say, I imagine in the American context, somebody would be, they'd have Scottish heritage, a quarter Scottish. But then a Scot might say, I know that some of my ancestors were Celts. I know that they were Highlanders. I know that some of them were Lowlanders. So there's the Anglo-Celtic thing, which has its own complications. You know, and you don't actually escape this just by coming from Britain rather than America. It's not something that just affects New Worlders, because, and I guess with Germans again, you mentioned Swabia, that as well. You know, I'm sure that the French have little things as well, as subcategories. But of course, as someone has pointed out, all of this pales in significance in the face of mass immigration from the Third World, or just from the rest of the world into Europe, because the difference between a German and a Frenchman, or let's say an Italian and a Swede, to take the extremes, is nothing. Nothing at all compared to the difference between an Indian and a Norwegian, or an African, a Congolese, and a Scot. I mean, those are just so radically different. And this is why you might not have the full genetic, you might not be fully genetically off a country, but by being born there and similar enough to its people, you effortlessly graft into it. It's very real. I mean, for example, I'm a quarter English and supposedly a quarter Italian, but really 7%. And yet I feel that I absolutely belong to my home town of Linlithgow. I mean, and my parents hadn't even grown up there or been born there. They were really, one was from Glasgow, one was from another town. And yet that town is, I am absolutely connected to Linlithgow.
Right, it's blood and soil.
Yeah, some people might not like that, but it is the truth. I mean, I still feel like Linlithgow lives in me, even though I'm hundreds of miles away. And I imagine it will always, the shape of the high street, the curve and all of this, the landscape, the surrounding fields, I know it so well. But that's not something genetic. And then someone would say, well, therefore genetics don't matter. It's all about your early life and your childhood. But I don't think that's true either, because this is the climate that my genetics evolved for.
Yes, and you have epigenetic factors. I absolutely agree. And I hasten to add, lest anyone thinks that this is either a purity spiral or some sort of hysterical self-doubt related to a lack of purity. It's none of these things. It's, for me, a part of certain fundamental truths that are inherent in stereotypes. Like, I talk to my wife, and she's like, oh, these are the Picards, you know. The Picards are like this. They are like this.
I'll just say this. Stereotypes, we have somehow been trained into believing that stereotypes are just fictions invented with no basis in reality, and yet people believed in them retardedly. That is obviously ridiculous. Stereotypes must gain traction because they marry up with reality to at least some extent, so that people recognize them and are amused by them, find them useful in conversation, etc. So of course stereotypes have, I mean, they're going to be at least 50% true. Unless there's been a lot of chicanery going on.
Yes, and I guess that's another way to understand what I'm getting at here. It's not about a purity spiral. It's like, if we know that there's a certain truth to stereotypes, then what is in my deck of stereotypes? What would potentially come out, and what circumstances would trigger it? I mean, I have a very distinctive thing, and I can't figure out if it's Greek, Italian, or French. Which is, and it's probably a bit of each of them, which is that if a fight's about to start, I become absolutely non-emotive. My face goes blank. And there's no, you don't signal anything. And you're also supposed to be more or less motionless, unless you're going to hide some sort of strike. you know, in a gesture that seems like something else, like, oh, help, you know. So there's this whole thing where it drops, right? And so, you know, the French have their concept of sang-froid, right? You know, be cold-blooded, be cool. But it's also an attitude of maintaining the rationality so that you don't allow yourself to freak out. Whenever I've been in a real crisis situation, this whole thing just goes whoomp. I mean, after mid-adolescence, before that, it was like, oh, I'm in a fight, ah, you know. But with adulthood, whenever there's a real crisis, like some guys surrounding me with knives, or when my car is about to rear end another one and I have to, you know, navigate within the space of a second and a half, this whole thing just settles on me and goes boom, cold. And you could easily argue that that's just that's an adaptation that exists across humanity if you want to survive. But you could also say it has different flavors, you know. I like to think the French or the Italian part is the one that wants to be absolutely cold and then start goading to cause the other one to run onto your, you know, rapier or your foil or whatever it is, right? Pink themselves.
I'm just probably the idea of you with a rapier is hilarious, but I can see it. It sort of works.
Yes, at a Ren Fest, right? With one of those big baggy shirts with a little lace up, you know, collar that has the strings hanging out of it, big puffy sleeves. Afterwards, I'll just sit down for a beer and pick up some hippie chick, you know. Yeah, nothing like a Ren Fest. That's one thing that I've been thinking about. You know, there are other things, though. As you say, you could turn it around and say that there are, you know, I've often felt that I have a choice about which direction to breed in. I know it sounds crazy, but you look at a person, you spend time with a woman, you've got a mate, and you're thinking to yourself, well, where is this going to go? I almost married a woman who was three quarters German and one quarter Kurdish. And that Kurdish aspect, whew, it fell into the category that there are some that are fun to play with, and there are others that are fun to keep, you know? And that was definitely like, wow, the German thought it seemed like it would all fit. But it won't. There are problems there. And so I joke with my wife. I'm talking, well, you're all French, you know, your family on one side and the other. They, one side, your father's side comes from this one region. Your mother's side comes from this other region. They may be 40 miles apart. And as far back as you can trace it into at least the late 1600s, both your mother and father's family have been there forever. So you're not just from France. You're from these. They are indeed two distinct regions, but they're right next door. They're very Catholic, you know, they're in the West. And I'm like, wow, you know, throw in my 12.5%. And suddenly you get a kid who's majority French, you know? So there is that angle too. I bring this up because there probably are some people who feel, you know, as white as I do, but who have this, panoply or patchwork of a history. And, you know, these are ideas that have occurred to me as I've gotten on in years. And, you know, perhaps it'll be useful. Perhaps other people have looked at that and said, well, I've got these characteristics. Which ones do I want to breed towards? And I think that patchwork, that genetic background, again, if what Dutton's talking about is true, I have no reason to believe it isn't. You know, he stays very up on these things. And it is indeed his area of specialization. There would have to be some corresponding aspect of moving towards a kind of characteristic. Like I had this friend who's a foot fetishist and he's got horrible feet. You know, I remember seeing him walk around in a pair of flip-flops once and I was like, good God, man. Holy shit. I love you and everything, but put some shoes on. And then I thought to myself, it makes sense, right? It makes sense that, you know, if that's an issue for you, you would find that your erotic attention. I mean, this is the same thing Dutton's talking about at a cultural level. If there comes this point of pressure and you've gotten to this point where there is so much dysgenic, there's so many dysgenic forces operating in a culture, collectively that culture would, in some emergent or spontaneous fashion, create crises like a war, or like his hypothesis about the wokery being a collective gambit also, that has been
it
arranged.
It also might explain, just thinking about it off the cuff here, it might also explain why inbred populations like Pakistanis are so wildly attracted to other ethnicities, because they detect that this is a way to get new genes into the gene pool. I don't know.
Yes, I've heard the same thing remarked upon with Iceland. Well, you know, Iceland, they're all so closely related, it's crazy. And if somebody shows up from somewhere else, you know, suddenly you have Icelandic women scratching at the door to get in, or men, as the case may be, because there is that sense. And so if we collectively are driven in this way, almost spontaneously, or in some emergent fashion, some fashion that I don't know if it's Sheldrake's morphic field or what, you know, but there is this sense that a collective can be driven in a particular direction because as a whole, it faces certain challenges. Well, if you physically face those certain challenges, then there are going to be certain things that you find attractive, or there's going to be a certain code that you find, you know, that woman smells great. No other woman smells good. I feel like I'm ensorcelled when I'm next to her because there's a certain code, an olfactory code. Or I've got terrible feet and I find I'm a foot fetishist, and I find myself, you know, strangely drawn to women who have beautiful high arches and nice, you know, regularly spaced toes, and they're of a commensurate length rather than having, you know, one jutting center toe. So this occurs to me too. And I think that people who have this mixed background, perhaps it will be useful for them to be armed with some of my own reflections. Then again, your mileage may vary. I'm crazy.
All right. Forgive me, but the foot fetish thing always makes me laugh. It just seems like the most, and it is actually, I believe, the most common fetish. This is why it's such a cliche.
Really? I've only met one ever.
I know several guys who have confessed it to me. It just seems funny to me. Like, of all the things, of all the parts to, you know. I obviously don't judge anyone for it. You can't really control this stuff. I'm going to Google foot fetish prevalence. And someone did a survey. They found that 18% of heterosexual men have a foot fetish. So, you know, one in five. There you go.
Well, but I mean, let's have some baseline or some control. What's a foot. Breast fetish?
Breast fetish. Well, I think most
breast guys, fetish prevalence.
I don't know, but I think we can assume that most guys are fans of breasts.
The type of breast that they would be attracted to might have to do with genetic predispositions as well. In defense of the foot fetishist, I mean, if you think about someone who has bad feet, that's like what an old friend of mine once told me, you know, if you want to bring somebody down in a fight, crush their foot, what are they going to do? And they won't be paying attention to that foot. You need something to stand on. Your survival prospects without good feet. I mean, just remember, as a culture, we have this whole idea of rogational processions, like in Christendom. When the plague came, everybody issued out of the towns. And remember, this wasn't a plague like monkeypox or, you know, the coof. This was a real live plague. They talk about numbers, you know, up to 75% of urban populations were dead. You know, the first bad waves of it that hit in the, I think it's 14th century, mid 14th century, they would get out and go into processional mode. So they'd line up behind the priests and, you know, they'd be praying and moving with their standards and things in procession. Well, think about what happens when you're some primeval group of humans and you see the volcano erupt near you and blot out the sun, and there are huge groups of animals fleeing. Well, when confronted with stress, you move. You move. And it's a spontaneous reaction that can even take place collectively. So even with the cities, with the Black Plague, people got out and started marching around in circles because the instinctive reaction is to move, just like we have the fight, freeze, flight response. I had this friend of mine who was coming home one night And a couple black guys pulled up, and this was in a good neighborhood. It was like 2 a.m. She was coming back from drinking, and one of them asked her for directions. And being properly programmed by our current society, she didn't want to be racist. So she walked over to the car to give them directions. Guy leaps out and starts cutting her throat and chest. And she stumbled off into her house and managed to wrap a jacket around her neck, got to the hospital. They stitched up her throat. It still got scars all over it. And immediately after that, she took up running and marathon running. It's a flight reaction, not just running. She wanted to be sure that she could run for hours. And so we have these spontaneous reactions, just an aside, but it does underscore the importance of feet in a crisis. And so if you had a genetic concern about your feet, I can see why you'd be driven unconsciously, subconsciously to seek out an attractive pair. It's much like hands. Women are very, very focused on hands, very focused on hands. They will be watching your hands, how your hands move, your gestures, you know, and these sorts of things in order to see if you're graceful. Because we breed for good hands. Women focus on those things. We're a little bit more blunt in, or we can be quite a bit more blunt as males, not all males. I'm very particular, but became more so as I got older, you know.
Did you show off your hands to woo your French wife?
No. But in the past, I did do things like I'd wear a ring here and a ring here, so they'd sparkle as I gestured or whatever, the same way that women wear little fishing lures on their ears or around their necks. You know, it's something to catch the eye. If you're like lighting a cigarette at a bar and you want to get their attention, it flashes and it emphasizes your movements. Yeah, but I used to be a rake. I no longer am. I'm no longer so concerned with those, you know, with the fishing game, get away closer and all that.
Did you wow her with your intellect and integrity and strength of character?
No, she got in touch with me because she has one of the things she does is art, artist, this sort of thing. And I did a stream on inspiration and methods for working the subconscious. The basic idea is you just take a card, and whenever you have an idea, don't do it on your damn phone. Carry a little set of cards with you. And whenever you have an idea, don't think about it too much. Write down on the card. Just write it down. And then, you know, stick it in your pocket. At the end of the day, if you're the kind of person like you, you're doing writing work, you capture ideas, you know that it's valuable, get it now before it scoots off under the bed, you know, like a rat running away. Seize it and commemorate it. Well, do it on a card. Drop it into a little box, just like you would have for a raffle, right? Where you fill out your thing and drop it in the box. Forget about it. Every day you'll have 5, 10 of them, whatever. Drop them in the box. And then I found that if you come back to it in, say, a month, wait for your box to fill up, 2 months, whatever is a creative cycle period for you that has passed enough time, come back and take a look at that. And what I find, do it on a day when you're not worried about some other thing. You know what the receptive days are, you know, where you're like, I can write today. I'm going to write today. This is a good day to write. Pick a day like that. And what I do is I use a huge board. In the old days, I got a piece of insulation and I just took pins. You know, you buy a big, you know, whatever, a meter and a half by 3 meters. I don't know that damn gay French measurement system, but, you know, you've got like a 4x8. And you put it out there and you just stick it up. Now I'm older, so I have a big magnetic dry erase board, a nice large one, and really powerful magnets. And what you do is you take those cards out and you put them up on this board. Don't do it on a screen. A screen traps you scrolling up and down. It keeps you on a line. It keeps it linear. Put it up on a board. And I discovered that these ideas are related. Some are. And you'll find that you can cluster them. You'll be like, wow, this idea actually goes with this one. And if I put them up on the board together, suddenly there's a new picture begins to emerge. And wait, there's this whole other group. And what seems these instances that if you see them diachronically, a longer line of time, diachronic is a term from linguistics. I'm not trying to be too grand, but it's useful because you contrast it with synchrony, whether it's across time or in one moment. And you find that the subconscious issues up these little bits and you scribble them down and then forget about them. Don't spend too much time trying to make a whole of them yet. But across time, you find that that diachronic aspect, the sequence of them in time, seemingly unrelated. When you put them on this board, and that's why I say get off the fucking line. Don't be on a line. Don't scroll. Don't get big. Put it on a wall where you can back up from it or walk close to it and see it and arrange it in different clusters or clouds or constellations. You find that what for you seems to be the diachrony, the sequence, has its synchronic aspect because the subconscious or the unconscious doesn't care about the sequence in time. And you're like, holy shit, I now have a way to get in touch with my subconscious creative process and see how in a timeless moment, it's issuing up these little blips that all go together that when assembled can give me a more fruitful creative process. So no, I didn't gesture with my hands. She got in touch with me about that. And then we were, you know, off to the races.
Yes. I didn't mean to seem sarcastic. I was,
no, it's good.
Being humorous. I didn't think that you would rely on such a cheap trick.
Don't
your hand gestures.
Don't think that. Once upon a time, I was, yeah.
I know. That doesn't matter now. All right. So with all of that as a sort of basis, you also wanted to talk, because it's relevant to what we've been saying, you also wanted to talk about Rudyard Kipling's The Stranger and what I was saying with Lichtmess a few nights ago. And, of course, that was spurred by the Magdeburg attack. Seems that, incidentally, just to suddenly make this political, it seems that the authorities in Germany are now settling on the idea that he was an Islamist or is an Islamist, and the other stuff was just lies and subterfuge to throw people off the scent.
Takiyye. Yeah,
exactly, takiyye. So who knows? But you wanted to talk about this problem, which is all over the West now, of the presence of the Auslander, the foreigner who comes in and we don't know what he's thinking. So what would you like to say about that?
Well, I fear that I've said a part of it in covering what we were going over previously, which is this idea that there are characteristics within us that are going to come out. They're going to be ways that we spontaneously show what we are and how we are, because as we were talking about earlier, the stereotypes are, you know, they exist for a reason, just as, you know, certain cliches exist for a reason. And so I don't know how I put it. One of the ones was, you know, they're trying to say that, you know, he must be a radical Muslim because he drove a car into a Christmas market. And I posted something on Twitter about that. I was basically saying, you know, why would we need to assume an Arab is a Muslim in order to explain why he behaved like an Arab? So I think there is some truth to that. Now, in terms of the particulars of this case, I put a tweet out yesterday because there's this woman who got some Iranian woman who now lives in Germany who posted this thing about how, oh, it's really takiyye if you look at these dodgy screenshots and dubious, you know, little digital bits that I've cobbled together, that I've grubbed together. You could see that he really must have been a crypto jihadist. And so I looked into it. She was claiming, you know, well, his name is Taleb Al Abdul Mohsen, and his name itself tells you that he's a crypto Shiite. And I know something about these things, so I looked into it. Taleb is Abu Taleb was the father of Ali, the fourth of the Muslim caliphs, and he was the son-in-law of Muhammad. He married Muhammad's daughter Fatima, and so, well, if he's got a name like Taleb, then he must be a Shiite. Well, yeah, except that Ali is one of the four rightly guided caliphs. The Sunnis venerate him too. You could say that Mohsin or Mohsen indicates that he has a Shiite background, except that Ali is important again Mohsin was one of the titles of Ali, if I remember correctly. So she's just sliming out this whole claim that it's a type of Shiite dissimulation. And it's very strange to hear that, because that's a way that the Sunnis go after the Shiites. Because they say, well, they've got the doctrine of Taqiyyah, which is essentially permissible dissimulation. They also have these other aspects, like Tawriyyah is a subcategory of Taqiyyah. Under doctrine, Tawriyyah is when I'm talking to you and I don't want to reveal something, so I give you an answer that could be interpreted two ways. It's like a double entendre. And it perfectly suits me for you to think of it in one way when I really meant it in this other way. So it's not really lying, right? There's other stuff like Kitman, which is pure deceit. There's Maruna, which is ideological flexibility, I guess. All of these are just ways to, you know, lie and not have it be something that you're constrained from doing as a Muslim. It's in defense of the believer or of the faith. But it's not that jihadists who get involved in violent attacks, they want to be a Ghazi. They want to be a warrior for the faith. They want to be a Shahid or a Shahid, a martyr for the faith. And that's why they all say, Takbir, Takbir. And they point at the sky with their one finger. You know, Allah is one, because Tawheed, unity, is the core of Islam, right? That's the Shirk, which is polytheism, God, the idea that there's...
I hate all of this. It's just so foreign to us and alien. And I hate that we have to know about this stuff. And I get it that you're very curious about other cultures. And so I see that you're into it. I'm sorry. I don't mean to deflate that. I think it's good people are into this, but it so pisses me off that we, whether we like it or not, have to be bothered with this.
Well, you said that with Martin, didn't you? I mean, like, we're forced to learn about these differences. Like, who wants to know the difference between a Jain, Pajit, a Sikh from the Northeast and the Northwest, or a Muslim Indian, or a Hindu, you know?
And yeah, that's their culture, that's their history, and all this weird stuff that's happened. Fine, that's theirs. This has got nothing to do with us. It's just so aggravating. I didn't mean to sort of cut you off there. It's just while you were going into it, I was thinking.
You're like, this is exactly what I never want to have to do.
Yeah. I want to know about German culture, German heritage, history. That's all fine. It's close enough that I can identify with it. And it's of intense interest to people that I care about. Fine. But all of this Arab stuff is just irrelevant. This is what I mean. It comes back to this pressing together of peoples that have nothing in common and so much to differentiate them that it just seems absolutely pointless and insane and destructive, because all that can actually happen in the long run is the erosion of all these things because they cost so much mental energy. So we'll just end up discarding them and we'll all become globalist consumers. Well, fucking great. I mean, what have we gained from this?
Yeah, I think there's going to be I think the most likely outcome, I can sort of frame this. Well, to end the previous thought, the basic idea was, I see no indication that he's a crypto jihadist. It just suits both Israel and the European Union, NATO and the West, to frame it as him actually being a Shiite in order to amplify fears of Muslim terrorism in the West at this time in order to support certain actions that Israel wants to take. That's it. But to your point about us being all forced together, this is something I brought up recently. I've thought about it quite a bit. Prison is the place where we have the greatest control. The largest number of, how shall I say this? Prison is a place where individual rights have been curtailed to the greatest extent. And this is the place where it's force, right? In the United States, if you get into some kind of trouble, they'll put you in SHU, right? SHU, which is the special housing unit. What that means really is they're going to put you in solitary confinement, right? They can punish you by sending you to the kitchens or whatever, where you have to work in the morning. They can remove all the little privileges you might angle for. The guards can use force. You can find that you have some terrible health issue and they don't take care of you, so you die because you're receiving medical care in prison. I mean, there are so many ways in which they can take care of you. They can take care of you by putting you in a cell with someone who's going to kill you, right? And there's a great deal of other types of incentives that can be applied. You know, nobody thinks about the noise. Like, if you want to complain about what it's like to be in a movie theater full of black people watching a film, you know, think about what it's like being locked in with hundreds and hundreds of them. The noise, as I understand it from my friends who've been to prison, is absolutely, it's cacophonous. It's insane. My one friend found a job working through the graveyard shift, so to speak, in the boiler room, where the sound of the machinery would create a white noise. And so he was able to retain some kind of a kind of solitude for himself, artificially created. So anyway, they have all these ways of smashing you. This is the place.
I was just before you go on, I was just thinking there, imagine being in a black woman's prison. Hardly worth thinking about. Sorry, go on.
May you live in interesting times. Well, this kind of environment is the one where they have the greatest degree of force that they can apply, the greatest degree of coercion, the large opportunities to try to draw you out with a carrot, right? Like, you get some good time and you get a little bit of time knocked off your sentence. Well, this is the place where they can do everything they want to the maximum possible extent. And yet this is the place where everyone immediately falls out into ethnic and racial groups as a matter of course. So in our great society, we keep getting told that if we do this and if we do this and if we do this, we'll all eventually come together. Well, the place where we have the greatest ability to impose is the place where everyone falls out rank and file into their different ethnic or racial cohorts. That's it. So when they talk about, you know, this idea that we'll all come together and we'll all be global citizens, I tend to think that won't happen. I did a stream with Apostolic Majesty some time back where we looked at the imperial policies, for example, of the Ottomans. And what you see there is they break people up into what they call millets, which are nations, but they're deterritorialized nations. So if you're Kurdish and Armenian and a Christian and Jewish and Muslim in a city like Imperial Istanbul, well, you don't really have territory. The Muslims, of course, do. They're the ones who can, you know, hold military ranks and do all the rest, leaving Janissaries aside. But the minorities, they have to pay a special tax. But the most important thing is that these millets, they get driven into their own little communities. It's just like prison in the sense that this neighborhood is a Kurdish neighborhood. And if you go into the Kurdish neighborhood and start some shit, as was told to me by Turkish friends when I first lived there, they're like, there is no such thing as a fight with one person. Literally 50, 60, 100 people will pour out into the street and beat you to death. Similar things can happen in a Jewish neighborhood. Similar things can happen in a Christian neighborhood, certainly in Muslim neighborhoods, certainly in Armenian neighborhoods. So these fools who push us together cheek by jowl, thereby increasing the friction, the tension, the violence, and the rest, the best they're going to be able to hope for is that the ranks sort of fall out into their ethnic, sectarian, and racial cohorts. And it's going to be like an imperial city where each of us gets to defend our own little neighborhood if we can, like blacks in Los Angeles or whatever, the greater LA area, or Compton, you know, once upon a time, who've now been driven out by Latinos, like the Irish and the Italians fighting over their turf in New York. You know, we've seen this over and over again. The only place where any kind of order can be maintained like that is a prison, or perhaps a place like Singapore, with the most draconian penalties to manage the ethnic differences, where if you spit on the street, you know, you're going to be caned. So I think that's the future that not only we can look forward to, but that is indeed unfolding around us and has been for some decades now. I mean, think about like Molenbeek or Beck or however the hell you say it in Belgium.
So just to be clear, the future that we can look forward to is segregation.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I don't see any other way around it. It is, in fact, what's happening now. I mean, what they talk about is as non-integration is segregation. I mean, these gregation words we need to look at more closely, because you've got, you know, non-integration, which is actually a kind of segregation, and integration itself should be understood as disintegration. Because by integrating these different groups, you are disintegrating the actual native populations, or the people who have, for example, developed over the course of their lives the relation to place, like, you know, the East End of London, you know, where are the Cockneys now?
The thing. This affects white people more than any. Because white people, for whatever reason, at least up till now, have been the most susceptible, the most amenable to these ideas of mixing with other peoples. So I don't, and I said this on Twitter, actually. I don't know if I'll be able to find it now, but it was about some earlier this year. Hold on a minute. I'll see if I can find this. But basically, a lot of the programming is especially effective on white people. And it just passes other races by. So I can imagine them being allowed to self-segregate, while white people are continually encouraged to mix. Because after all, I do believe that we are the target of all this. I mean, no one really cares whether the Indians exist in 200 years or not. But white people do seem to be the target here.
Yes, and I think we're a very literate people. And that, I think, carries with it certain risks, which is a part of what I'm working on. I'm trying to get this damn translation of a Circassian book finished, a Circassian text that written in Ottoman. The translation's done. I'm just typesetting it now and doing the design and the rest. But I need to get it out because it discusses how people organize themselves with tribal and clan marks, you know, like horse brands or territorial marks or heraldic insignia. And I intend to connect this to what you're talking about, so bear with me if you will. But we have been made highly literate, and that, I think, is in large part why the focus of our masters, a heterogeneous group of masters, by the way, why they have focused so much on linguistic manipulation, right? You have this idea of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis that our reality and our behavior is shaped by our lexicon and how it corresponds to the concepts that are available to us to understand a certain thing. So they play games with words, right? Like what they call ethnic cleansing is living in a peaceful community, homogeneity. So we don't talk about homogeneity. What we do, or peaceful communities, or integration in a genuine sense, we talk about ethnic cleansing, right? We substitute a term that carries with it this whole freight of negative shit that's been hammered into us through imagery. And this causes us to veer away from a whole course of thought and action because of how we've been constrained linguistically. And it emerges that most of these other cultures aren't that way. They have other ways of organizing themselves, of integrating their behavior in time and space, which doesn't allow this type of substitution of these weasel words, these slithering little terms that make certain things no-go areas. See, what happens with linguistics, and I don't want to go way deep into this, but the basic idea is you have the idea of the arbitrary nature of the sign. And so Saussure and others, they come in and they say, well, we've got all these different words for tree. They all refer to tree. So really, the words we use are totally arbitrary. And that whole idea of linguistic arbitrariness, which is a keystone of it, was carried over by structuralism into all these other aspects of the humanities. And it really ties this idea of the tabula rasa, the blank slate. It's arbitrary. We can choose what it will be. And if we give you new pronouns, then you'll be a new thing. We'll have some new self-creating new man. And that person will be ushered in by our efforts to remove the boundaries that otherwise constrained our ratiocination, right? But other cultures, they don't.
I mean, I think that has really come up against reality. I don't know if this has been acknowledged yet, but probably not to the. But I think it's becoming acknowledged in some ways that there are problems. Just calling a brown guy an Englishman, there are problems there. It's not straightforward because he looks in the mirror and he sees a brown guy. There are problems with calling someone a woman who's had her breast removed. Calling her a man, it's not straightforward. I mean, even from the best point, the most charitable, progressive point of view, I think they're coming to realize this was an impossible dream. This was a delusion that we could author reality just with the words that we apply to it.
But it's so central to their thinking. Gramsci was a linguist, you know, and it's very important to understand that. He was a trained linguist. And his prison notebooks and all the rest, you know, the linguistic ideas of reframing things are central to it. And they've been central to the Frankfurt School and the entire project that we've been on the receiving end of. It has to do with assuming everything's arbitrary. So let's name the things in such a fashion that it yields the results we want. We white people are very inclined to be concerned about text. I tend to think now, I used to be a strong believer. I love the idea that the United States had all these public libraries and there was universal literacy and we could all have this future for ourselves because, you know, we had access to all these works and the rest. And I think for most people, it's actually a kind of poison because of the kind of linguistic substitution that is enabled thereby. So these people think that they are literate, but in fact, they're lost in this game of arbitrary substitution. And what we have is an alternative, right? You also have, with the idea of the blank slate is the idea that humans are something different. The idea of the blank slate is that instincts are something that we can separate ourselves from. In fact, what we can do is subvert instincts and introduce noise into the instinctive signal so that there's risk, like my friend who got her throat cut. I don't want to be a racist. If I didn't walk over to this car full of black guys in the middle of the night, you know, then I would be a racist. And so the language, this, because language is tied to thought processes that we can make explicit to ourselves. When we think I am a this, I am a that, it happens in words. When we want to talk to something to someone else about something in order to articulate it, to make it rational, the logos, the word, we have to put it into speech. But these other cultures and peoples for whom in large part the idea of someone who is literate is a group that stands apart. It's not accessible to everyone. It's a Brahmin or it's a rabbi or, you know, it's a Taoist sage or what have you, right? For these peoples, they tend to focus more on what I think of as the earliest writing. I probably brought this up in our previous millennial discussions in the past, but it fits here. If you don't want to embrace this foolish idea, I think, of human beings being entirely distinct from all our biological ancestry down through the various species, if you don't want to embrace this blank slate idea, I think, and this is something I'll be working on in future, it's a book I'm working on after I finish this one, it's this idea that there is writing that came before speech, and it's the writing and the marks made by animals. What do these marks do? They indicate hierarchy, something we've tried to dispense with by flattening everything. They indicate territorial claims. They indicate descent, right? The olfactory invisible marks in an animal's environment indicate what territory they patrol. Are they patrolling it all the time? Is the dog pissing there all the time? So if another dog comes and smells it, he says, oh, this isn't just a territorial mark, it's a recent one. Well, then they go, how far up the tree did the urine from the dog hit? Oh, wow, that's a big dog, bigger than me. I'm going to back off. That's how they organize themselves socially. Now, even the ones who they call the hafiz, right, who's memorized the Quran or whatever, usually they do so verbally by listening to it, and they can recite it. So even in cultures where we think they're highly literate, it's not quite the same thing as this thing of the text and reading. And so what we have is, as white people, is this predisposition to embrace text as the highest form of civilization. We say that it's what makes civilization possible. We even say that what happened before writing isn't even part of history. Literally, if you'll allow the expression, that which comes before writing is prehistory. And so if we didn't even have a history at the time, it must be before civilization. Writing is really what comes and gives us civilization. But really what it is at first is accounting. And you have really complex civilizations that develop primarily based upon accounting. And then it becomes something that captures the spoken word much later. But my argument is that we have a kind of writing, and these other cultures still use it, which it, we inherited from animals, and it comes before speech. It turns the whole idea that writing must be something that captures speech on its head, because there's a writing that comes before speech, following tracks on the ground. You follow them in linear order. You see what happened. This wolf was chasing this deer, and at this spot, it bit it because I can see blood on the ground. And then it brought it down here. And it's not just a wolf of any category. It's a particular wolf. And so this older kind of writing and understanding is something that that all cultures embraced in the past. All across Europe, we used marks that were either non-linguistic or borderline. They were merchants' marks, potter's marks, hallmarks. Or when you went to a bar or a pub, and it was, you know, the Green Dragon or the Black Boy or whatever, right? You knew what it was. They said it, and you had a rebus, an image on the sign that was like, well, it's the Green Dragon. There's a dragon, and it's green, so I know I'm at the right place. I don't need to read the words. We have had that taken away from us, in large part by some things that happened in the middle of the 20th century. You will recall that certain people in Central Europe in the middle of the 20th century got really interested in organizing people beneath signs and symbols. And they had these old traditions of Hausmarken, right? Which were their kind of like household signs. Now we will sort of tolerate a monogram. A monogram's okay because, you know, MW stands for Millennial Woes. Yes, it's a symbol and a sign, but it's not necessarily something that you should reject out of hand because it looks like a symbol. A cross, we're getting a little weird about that. Crescents we're good with, right? Crescent moons. But we never want to see people marching beneath banners, beneath flags, or like the lambda symbol of Generation Identitaire. That's where we come in hard. That's where we come in hard, shut it down, because that level of communication, where it's fundamentally a territorial mark, where it's fundamentally a mark of confraternity in some sense. Like, think about if two football teams get together and you've got this scarf with these two colors that they're wearing, and then this whole group over here is wearing these scarves with these other two colors. We don't even want that. We call it football hooliganism because it's about a territorial claim. The people collectivize or cooperate as you prefer, and they come together. And anyway, this was a long-winded way of getting into it, but I think that there's a very specific way in which our great failing, our great danger, the struggle that stands in front of us, is that we have to find a way to operate outside of language. That there are ways that we need to organize ourselves socially that we formerly did use to organize ourselves socially, that are not currently made available to us because of certain associations from the middle of the last century. And yet these are fundamental ways that we can organize, integrate our behavior, cooperate, and collectivize without the ability to substitute. You could still have a false flag. I mean, a false flag is fundamentally, I wave the false sign, right? So it doesn't mean that you cannot lie, right? We've got the war crime of perfidy, right? Which is, for example, to have an ambulance that's actually carrying weapons because it carries the Geneva Convention recognized, you know, cross symbol, so you're not supposed to fire on it. That's perfidy, or a false flag, or these things. You can still lie, but not in this strange way that freezes the instinctive reaction through the subversion of the thought process through the manipulation of language. And of course, that process goes back through things like Christian canon law, all the way back to things like pill pool and the religions of the book and the predispositions of certain types of people. In this respect, I'll assign it to the entire class, like lawyers, right? Where the idea is, well, I mean, you know, it's phrased this way, but really there's, you know, we can come up with a way around this, you know. Is this really what God was saying? You know, so yeah. If we have to step outside of this linguistic subversion, and I think that in large part what you're talking about, the way in which we're happy to have these things done to us, to be disintegrated, is because we can't fall back on this fundamental biological form of writing, which is territorial and hierarchical marks and signs. We're not supposed to have territory. We're supposed to be deterritorialized. And we certainly can't have hierarchy. We've all got to be at the same level. This is egalitarian. It's flat land. It's a tabula rasa.
Just today on Twitter, I saw a woman. It keeps cropping up in my notifications. It's a conversation that I can't reply to because I'm blocked by the original person. So all I can do is keep seeing these replies from this stupid woman. Anyway, someone was saying to her that native Brits are being replaced in their own country. And she said, there's no such thing as native Brits.
Oh, I saw this. Yes.
Yeah, I think you probably... Yeah, yeah. So... And someone else said, well, what these people are indigenous to Britain. And she said, well, that's not true.
Rousal, yeah.
Because, and so she's taking issue not with the actual facts, which are fucking obvious to everyone, but with the use of the words native and indigenous, because they actually mean something else. And and it's just spaghetti, which ultimately is intended to make it impossible for us to declare our ownership of this land, even though our ownership of this land is a real thing. If you can't express it and articulate it and justify it, then it becomes a not real thing. It becomes a fantasy, according to her. According to her thinking, I'm guessing. Because... The truth is self-evident. I mean, if people have been there for thousands and thousands of years, then how can you say that they're not indigenous? Well, only if you tinker around with the meaning of the word indigenous. But then that means that virtually nobody is indigenous to anywhere on Earth. But that doesn't bother her. She doesn't care. It's just about depriving us of our ownership of this land. I mean... I think this is the sort of thing that it's not exactly what you're talking about, but it's related to it, where if we invest everything, we depend on language to justify things, then the language becomes a vector of attack by our enemies, because they can subvert the language, then we can't use it in the way that we would naturally use it. I mean, I take the point. I think I do follow everything that you've said. It seems that symbols, for example, as you said, they're territorial. They denote predominance, or they profess an intention to establish predominance. And so therefore they have to be banned, because that is the start of it. That professing is the start of the establishing. So things like that. Language in that sense has to be controlled. I mean, it has to be controlled in almost every sense now, because what's going on now is so radical and so extreme that you couldn't... It's so unnatural. I think that's the key thing. It's so bizarre and so out of keeping with history that you have to control the ways people can talk about it, because otherwise they will just declare that this is unnatural and bizarre and out of keeping with history.
It introduces a gap between impulse and action. And the old European, at least insofar as at least from my perspective of what the old European was, it was a masterful killer, the world's best killer. There are still tigers in India. Tigers will get loose in a village and drag people off. We don't have that anymore. We don't have enormous cave bears anymore. And we didn't have, game rifles to take care of them. We had to crowd around them with flint spears. We used to have Smilodons, saber-toothed tigers. I don't know, in fact, if they overlapped with the appearance of humans, but you take my point. There were dangerous, savage beasts here, and we had a fairly harsh environment in many areas, certainly compared to, for example, sub-Saharan Africa, and we became very effective killers. And there's much that's made of the domestication, the self-domestication of the European. Nietzsche goes into that quite a bit, with the idea that they had to come in with things, codes that were harsh in order to hammer these people into a shape where they could control their impulses, because they would be very, very violent and conclusively violent, right? Not what we call down south a Yankee cuss fight, right? Where we're all just going to start shouting and then we'll shout louder and then we'll shout louder. No, I'll kill you. Those are fighting words. This kind of thing. And so language, particularly language in a religious context, gives us this tool where we say, I've studied the scripture and the word. I have paid attention to the ethical examples that have been set forth for me, right? And so I know that I must suspend the impulse. There lies, the path to vice. I must instead embrace virtue and in some sense stop the impulse before it goes. And so the text, particularly the sacred text, but also the text of the law, which is raised and is seen like on a stele, like the Code of Hammurabi, or Solon's laws that were on these rotating wooden cylinders that, he innovated so that you could turn them and read that text because it stands. It is the tablet of the law. So the text served as a way to help us to better integrate our behavior and overcome our impulses. But to your point, what's happened now is this gap has been introduced between impulse and action where, I see three black guys coming down the street towards me at 2 a.m. I shouldn't cross the street because then I'd be a racist. But my impulse is to cross the damn street. My impulse is to be to find this person and their behavior alien at a minimum, and perhaps even repulsive. But that cannot be permitted because this gap has been introduced between impulse and action, and it comes through the subversion of language. And so think about someone like the neurotic character that Woody Allen is so famous for playing in his films. Right. Well, now I'm not quite sure if I'm supposed to do that. If I did that, then it's that kind of paralysis. And they joke, they say the paralysis of analysis. But again, to come back to my point, kind of loop it together with what you're talking about, that's why I think that this other way of organizing our behavior that's much more older and much more instinctive, perhaps the time has come for the pendulum to swing back in the other direction, because we have need of heeding our instincts. And it is specifically our instincts, both individually and collectively, if you'll allow that. That's what we need now. We are supposed to say, oh no, I don't trust that. That smells wrong.
We need to have that situation where a white woman sees a black guy in the middle of the night and thinks, fuck this, I'm running the other way. Without any intervention by bullshit getting in the way and making her go towards the car like a lamb towards the slaughter. It's appalling. But some people said, one person said, we need a resurgence of spirit. I can't remember the full comment now, but I think the point was that all of this can be used to, what you're talking about can be used to confuse, disorientate, weaken, neutralize us. And this is the danger of analysis. This is the danger of getting too much into this, where you're divorced from reality, and that your energies are actually diffused. I think that's a major thing here. Also, there was another one. Oh yes, Brosie said our tolerance has been abused for too long, and I think this is the very sort of bare bones conclusion of what you're seeing here, that we need to get back to reality. We need to get back to what actually matters, what is really happening here, and not dazed by pill.
Yes, but there's a very specific thing here, which is our tolerance has been abused for too long. That raises the question of, okay, how has it been abused? Well, we know that it's been abused through language. I mean, look at the whole thing with fucking pronouns. Like, I say, my name's Oliver. You know, okay, my name's Oliver. Well, maybe I'm going to change my name, right? Or my wife changes her last name, right? This is a choice. It's about a proper noun, right? There is a domain in the structure of language for a proper noun. That's okay. This is one slot where you can substitute, right? When you're looking at the menu, you're like, okay, well, here it could be this or this or this. Choose a side of rice or, you know, black-eyed peas or whatever. But this is the rest you get in your meal. This is the structure of language. Where, and then they play games with the nouns, right? First, you say Negro, right? Because these people are black, right? And so we say they're black and we're white, and so we call them Negroes. And well, you know, and then there's another naughty, naughty, naughty word, the N word, which is just a slightly different pronunciation of Negro, which means the exact, absolutely the exact same thing. But we're not allowed to say that. So what we do have to say instead is colored people. Well, wait, you can't say colored people. Nope. We have to say black. Well, wait a minute. Doesn't Negro and the evil word we're not supposed to say, don't they mean black?
People of color as well as the other one, because colored is now, to say colored is now seen as bad.
Right. So we then substitute it with colored people. Well, sorry, colored people get substituted with people of color. I'm like, give me a fucking break, man. But that is the domain of manipulation with a proper noun. You move to pronouns. And now we're getting to something that stands for a noun. That noun, as you well know from paying very close attention to writing, as I know you do, it the pronoun references its antecedent, right? So it stands for this other thing. And that's all well and good, but now we're introducing all these other pronouns. So essentially what's happening is we're moving deeper into the language to create uncertainty and a delay. Like, wait a minute, where I would normally just say the damn pronoun, right? There are a few choices, he, she, it, right? Pretty straightforward in English. Oh, no. You have to grasp this entire deck of potential pronouns. And by the way, all sorts of new ones are going to be shuffled in and out all the time, which means now I'm trying to reference something in my speech, which is the core of it. Like, we're now getting closer to subject and predicate. When they start screwing with that, we'll know that it's all falling to pieces. So anyway, my point was simply to underscore that they drive ever deeper in the subversion of language. They've moved from this slot that you could be allowed to change, right, into deeper structural elements, syntactically, grammatically, of the language. So when we say, yes, our tolerance has been abused, absolutely it has. How? Okay, it's been done through language. Well, here's the big problem. Language is associated with civilization and progress, right? If we can all read and write, there's more progress. But if fewer people can read and write, well, there's not as much progress. But now it's regressive, you know. Ooh. The problem is that when we start thinking about what do we do if we want to get out of the area of linguistic subversion, how do we do it? Well, then you say, well, there's no other place to stand. But give me a lever long enough and a place to stand and I'll move the world. And then you're like, well, I want to fix my civilization. How could I possibly step outside of language? They'll tell you that you can't even think without language. They'll tell you that. You can't even think without language. How could you possibly cooperate with without language? Well, I don't know, work songs with a rhythm. People rowing a boat to a song. Soldiers marching in step with a cadence. Military forces aligning themselves on a battlefield by listening for the other positions of the men as they shout their war cries. You know, in the heat of battle, you got shield walls smashing up against each other. You're going to be looking up above huge clouds of dust kicked up. Even back in the black powder days, you can't even see what the hell is going on. But if your line gets pushed in and you begin to have a serious penetration, then you can be cut to pieces. If your line falls back.
I take these examples, and of course another one would be facial expressions and gestures. But realistically, we are not going to communicate without language. That's not going to happen. I mean, we need language to plan a battle, to get the resources to where they need to be, to order the soldiers to do whatever. It's not really about... I don't think we can realistically hope to abandon language, verbal language. I think what we can hope to do is remarry it to reality. Wouldn't you say so?
Indeed, but I'm not suggesting that we all need to take vows of silence, though I've thought quite a bit about vows of silence, and I've thought about what a person who had made a vow of silence for a period would make of all this sort of Woody Allen pilpul. So I say that to underscore the point that I'm not necessarily saying we need to turn loose of spoken language or written language for that matter. But I do think that we should seek to engender within ourselves an understanding that there are all these other ways of cooperating and working. Like, you raise a banner and people gather around it. You raise a banner and march in a certain direction and you have a cadence and people can cooperate. They can say, heave, ho, heave, ho, to lift the log. I mean, or raise the wall on a barn that you're all cooperating to build. Or take a look at with women. Men run into all kinds of problems because they assume that the words matter when they're talking to women. And they don't in the same way. The tone of voice matters. They sing in the same way. They're saying words, whatever. You know, whatever. They're saying words, but really they're going, and the other one's going, And that's not to dismiss women or emotions. But we have to understand that there is this vast domain and it's a variety of different things. I mean, like you said, there's gesture, right? They mean things, right? That can't be made ambiguous in the same way. Song, rhythm, meter, patterns, geometry itself, and indeed these marks and signs. You don't. I went to China to study pharmaceutical products there in order to come up with a name because some patent for a diabetes drug was expiring, and so this big pharma company was going to come up with a generic for it, and they needed a name, and so I was busy talking to people in these different cultures to understand them, and you find very often that text itself, it doesn't have to be read in order to signify something. And that gives a basis for understanding and cooperation. Like with the Chinese, I talked to people who, I listened to people being asked questions I had written by a moderator in one of these focus group facilities. And they're asking about, whether or not they like traditional Chinese medicine. And they're like, screw that shit. We don't want traditional Chinese medicine. Give us the damn pills. We want modern medicine. You know, I'm not some Taoist riding a fucking water buffalo. You know, I want my medication. And so it became apparent that they are more inclined to trust a product if there's English writing on the side. But they don't read English. It's a mark. Or another example that people don't really think about. If I'm an illiterate soldier fighting for the French in World War I, and I've lost my way, and I'm trying to figure out whether I'm in German territory or French. And I come across this farmhouse, and I find a book. And the writing in it is Fraktur, right? Black letter Gothic typeface that the Germans used, that nobody else used. It's a territorial mark. I don't even have to read the book to know where I am. I can orient myself in space and time. So I'm not saying at all that we need to dispense with spoken language. I'm saying that we on the right know that everything about our culture and our civilization, down to our own individual behavior, has been subverted through spoken language. We know that the people who are busy subverting us are experts in the subversion of language, and that they've been planning it for quite some time. Their best minds and thinkers, who are not shoddy thinkers. These are not shitty thinkers. Everything that they've done has been successful. What I'm saying is, what's the area that they don't feel comfortable in? What are the areas where they haven't mastered this? What are the areas that they don't understand? They stole a march on us by subverting language, by introducing arbitrariness into it, or by weaponizing a natural arbitrariness that they recognized within it. So if we would like to do the same thing, wouldn't it make sense to delve deeper? Is it in, I can't remember what Shakespeare it's in. Is it, you know, hoist with their own petard, you know? Go dig the deeper mind beneath them by going deeper into culture, by going deeper into history, by going deeper into animal behavior, and weaponizing for ourselves against them these other domains of social organization.
The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction.
Yes. I'm sorry, I have a French wife now, so I'm constantly saying, yes. So hopefully that carried the point across. I got a bit long-winded with it. But there are other areas, other domains that are older and that operate at a deeper level where I think it would be in our own best interests to apply our attention to see what opportunities they present for getting around this linguistic subversion.
All right. Well, I don't even know where to go from there. But I'll tell you where we will go. I'll tell you where, because it's something that I do want to ask you about. And I mean, obviously, that this actually touches what we were just saying there. It touches on what you talked about a millennial a few years ago, about 3 years ago, if I like. That's my feeling. 2020, 21, where you talked about this thing about this symbols and markings, animal markings and so on. So it's obviously been on your mind for some time. But to get into the matter of writing, you wanted to talk about venturing into Substack. As someone who is a creature of YouTube, a creature of, you know, video streaming and so on, Substack is a new thing for you, as it was for me 2 years ago, and it still feels new to me now, to be honest. I'm still quite very much enjoying it. Why don't you talk about your transition from a streamer to a writer?
Well, I've always been primarily a writer, and I went with streaming because it was my understanding that this is the medium, right? There's so much that can be communicated in your gesture or your tone of voice and all the rest, things you're well aware of. So I went into that domain, and then I got shunted aside from what they call effort posting, you know, writing a script, producing it, editing it, and posting it by the ease with which you can simply turn on a live stream and roll with it, right? But that suffers from the whole thing of, I would have written you a shorter note, but I didn't have time, right? The listener is subjected to all the imprecision that comes with attempting to fumble your way through it in conversation and speech. And so I turned back to writing because of some things I wanted to say, like people, if they're interested in my Substack, it's called The Royal Book of Spiritual Chivalry. It's available over on Substack, and I have part one and part two up there called Defending the Conspiratard. And I basically wanted to defend the habit of mind that is dismissed by so many, particularly on the right, as being a conspiratard. And I found that there's just, it's best done in the written format. Because as you spit these things out in speech, they sort of pass through. People are listening. Sometimes they're listening at double speed, or they're doing dishes, or, you know, getting in and out of their cars. They listen to a podcast, and so some part gets lost. And inevitably, a certain portion of what you're trying to communicate is lost. And so I think to myself, well, you know, I want to go back to writing. Indeed, I wrote scripts. And one of the reasons why I went over, and I've written scripts for film as well, some of which have been made into movies, and one of which even won some awards. But I'd write these scripts, and I would do them, you know, reading them for my thing. And I'm like, wow, this is hard to listen to. You don't speak. That's not naturally how you speak. When you read your writing, it's not naturally how you speak unless you're very careful to do it. You've had very considerable success with that. Some of your live speeches that you've done. What was that one you did where you used all yellow and black? You like turned the video of it into a duotone.
Yeah, it was the Hope Not Hate speech in 2019. Very difficult to do, actually.
Yeah, well, yes, it is. It's extremely difficult to do. And I guess that's what I wanted to underscore. If you want to have a speech that's considered and thoughtful and does not waste the listener's time, you have to do a considerable amount of work to write it out. But then you've got to do another pass, unless it's your native talent. It isn't mine, in order to make it conversational and straightforward, and not with these weird multisyllabic, you know, words. And you even find that some words are difficult to pronounce in a script when they're right next to each other, because it ends on a consonant and begins on a consonant. So I found that by writing my stuff out and then speaking it, it was stilted. And so I said, well, I'll go with the live streams. Now I'm trying to go with the text again. And perhaps it's because I've cultivated what small audience I have through the streaming. There doesn't seem to be much carryover. I don't see a huge wave of interest in what I do on X or on YouTube carried over to Substack. It's a very different process. I think people turn to writing for a very different reason. They want to sit down and read something, and they can't be doing something at the same time in the same way that they can when they're listening to a podcast. And so this is raising a question for me, you know, which way should I go? There's a forking path, you know, which way, sequestered man? Which direction do I take it? And that brings me to a whole other set of messes about our relationship with the written word. I think another thing that we have to recognize is that we're not literate, even though we claim to be. The number of people who can read the writing and sound the words out and make sense of the sentences is much greater than it's ever been in our history, surely. But I think, not to exaggerate too much, I mean, I'm sure there are more people now who read still, but the number is very small. And so it becomes a question of for whom do you wish to write? I kind of wanted to bring this up to hear your thoughts on it, because on the one hand, you have this idea that, and it came up, I was going to mention it to you, and I saw that it got mentioned by Dutton, you know, how Nietzsche said that some people were born posthumously. The other way to put it is he would say they're posthumous authors, which means it's guaranteed that only at some future date will your audience sort of appear as it should. Because people today are not able to catch up with you, and you're thinking ahead about what will be. But that brings other difficulties. I'll wrap this very quickly and ask your thoughts, but it brings a couple of other difficulties with it. If you're going to write in that sense where you're writing for a future audience, well, that's a heavy weight upon you. You know, even if you're just trying to gather together the facts as an analyst, you know, so to speak, for some future researcher to see the fact that you gathered to your point about, you know, with Dutton about how some things disappear and they're no longer available. Even that is like, well, I have to write for it to be to a historical standard responsibly and to, you know, check my, it becomes a more serious undertaking. And if you truly want to write as one who is a posthumous author, then you have to have a pretty grand opinion of yourself and your vision to say that people today simply cannot understand me. Only in the future, perhaps, will some people be born who will understand my greatness, right? But on the other side of things, the podcasting and the rest, this is a very ephemeral medium. I mean, you post something, and if it's tied to the news, I mean, what's its lifespan? 3 days, you know? For how long can you expect to see, you know, the view count increase before it levels off? And so there are certain exceptions to that. Millennial is one of them, because I've maybe gone back and watched one of my streams with you, and I don't even remember them particularly well. So for me, Millennial is interesting because, well, first off, because it's a brilliant idea. Everyone wants things to watch and listen to that they enjoy. And Christmas is when everybody stops because they're all doing holidays. So you've gone in a quite canny fashion. And I don't even know if it was fully intentional, but it damn sure worked out. You find the gap where there is that need there. And this time of the year where everyone is like, damn, I really wish there was something to listen to, but everyone's away for the holidays. Millennial really is like a Christmas gift, because I'm like, this whole period, I'm like, oh, I guess I'll go watch this one. And I've got time too, because I'm off for the holidays, and I'll watch this one, and I'll watch this one, and I'll watch. It's like a damn buffet, you know, or it's like the boards are creaking with the feasts that's been laid, right? And to finish that point, I swear I'll shut up. Millennial is interesting because you're capturing, well, coming back to diachronic and synchronic, you're capturing these different people who are part of this world, and you're capturing them across time, because many of them will come again and again and speak about different things. Some of them you'll find, like Jared Taylor, he's like, I've been saying the same thing the whole time, and I'll keep saying it because it has to be said. And they're on focus, they're focused, they're on message. Other ones you'll be like me, where I'm like, you know, shitlib adjacent, alt-light. And then you invite me on and you're like, why did your opinions change? And then you get to see the trajectory shift. So you're getting a snapshot of these groups of people at one moment each year, but you're also getting to see their development across time. This is an exception, though, to most of the podcast stuff. It's just, it's like a fart in the wind. It gets pissed away, tears in the rain, you know? And so I guess that's setting the stage for my inability to decide what to focus on now, because the writing calls out to me. But it's, I'm certainly never going to develop enough of a, I don't expect I would develop enough of a following on Substack to get any kind of income or much of, much in the way of attention. You know, how do you balance this out? I mean, you've been focusing on Substack hard. I mean, all through the year, you're producing. And I've seen some of the apps you put together, which I'm, in fact, a bit quite interested in, you know, because they're like my inspiration thing. You're like, how do you track the idea and lay them out and see how they might relate and move them through a workflow? You know, what's your deal with this?
Well, there's a lot there to pick up on. I wrote a list while you were talking because I thought I'm going to forget all of this. All right, so the first thing is about not much carryover from YouTube and other platforms onto your Substack. You've got to, like, I mean, I've mentioned my Substack quite a lot in this millennial, and I think I did it last year as well. But I mean, these things grow the more you do them. It's like any platform. The more content you put up, the more people discover it and discover your thing thereby. So that's one thing. You should just mention it everywhere. I didn't even know that you had a Substack, so I've just added it. I will add it when this stream is finished. I'll add it to the description so that people can find it. That kind of thing is essential. I mean, that's what I've been trying to impress upon Lichtmess as well, that you've got to advertise, make it as easy as possible for people. because human nature is like that. It's the path of least resistance. It's the pleasure principle. People are, I'm like that. Everyone's like that. You do as little as possible and until the thing grabs you, and then you're engaged in it. So that's one thing. About the carryover also, I would say it's different platforms and different people like different things. Some people will love your Substack. They'll discover your Substack and they won't even know that you're a YouTuber. They won't know that you've got this previous life or ongoing life as a streamer. It's a weird thing. I think there are people who discover my Substack and then they're rather shocked to find that, oh, Millennial Woes is a controversial character. Because it's just a different life. That I'm doing different things there. I do write about my standard topics, but I write about many other things as well. So different platforms ask different things of you and illuminate different parts of you. So that's how that goes. Posthumous fame. I'm not yet making a living from Substack. I hope to by the end of next year. If I'm not by the end of next year, I'm going to have to think very seriously about what to do, because I'll be 43 then. And I don't know. It's frightening, actually. I just hope that's a problem that resolves, because I hope I'm writing good stuff that's worthy of being read, that enough people value it that they'll pay for it. I mean, that's what you've got. That's the hope of any content creator, whatever medium they're working in. So that's one thing. Posthumous, I do think that our work in every medium will be valued after our lifetimes. In 100 years, 200 years, people are going to be wondering what the hell happened. What was it like at the start of the 21st century? And what was it like to be living through it, at least partly aware of what was going on, while the broad public were just oblivious? What was it like to be sentient during a time of decline? Because for some reason, most people just aren't cognizant of it. They just, you got to force it into them. Like the meme about the guy grilling at his barbecue. Just, it's staggering, because we're looking at the end of a civilization here, and yet most people don't seem to care or be interested or even notice.
Yes.
And I think that's partly because they just don't feel they have the permission to notice. And also they're busy. They're busy doing an office job or whatever, 8 hours a day, getting up in the morning, putting on clothes, going somewhere, doing it, coming back, going to sleep. With all of that and the worries about mortgage and family, children, it's a lot to then take on, to analyze the world and realize, oh, fuck, this society is in serious trouble. It's a lot to take on cognitively and emotionally. So I do tend to hope and I do tend to think that all of this that what we're doing will have more life in 100 years, 200 years, because there'll be more people open to it then. I think there are a lot of people open to it now, but they're not necessarily going to find my Substack or your Substack, but right. But they are open to it. They are there. They are looking, but they might not find it. Again, this is why it's crucial to advertise as much as you can. Another thing about that, by the way, is what I'm intending to do next year is some sort of video related to or inspired by each of my essays. Now, I started doing it this year, but I failed because I was relying on other people who turned out to be, it was just difficult to nail people down to get to do a chat about each one. I might just do it myself, because then you can just do it whenever you've got a spare hour, it's done and you can move on. Weirdly, Millennial is much easier to organize than this, what I was calling the stack chats. But maybe that's, I don't know. It just seemed to turn out that way. But the point I'm making here is interaction between your, It's like whenever I did a speech, I always made sure to record it because I thought if I'm going to go to the effort of giving a speech, which is a lot of effort and money, because I would often pay for I paid for my travel to the conference and so on. So if you're going to do all that, then you might as well maximize what you get back from doing it. So record it, and then you can upload it on your channel, and it's a video. And it's a special video, because people always quite liked the speech videos. So either that, or you just content yourself with the people who happened to be there at that conference on that day. But why? When you could multiply that audience by 100 or 1,000 on your channel. So similarly, I would say when you write an essay, or an article in Substack, it makes sense to maximize if you're going to go to the trouble of writing something, and it is hard work, as you said, then you might as well maximize what you get back for doing that. So make a video about it. If not reading out the essay from beginning to end, which I don't think is always successful, at least do a talk about it, or maybe do a talk with someone else about it. So that's that. Maximizing. When you've already done most of the work, you might as well do this little extra bit that multiplies it. On writing being very considered, yes. And I think maybe this is another reason why I sort of burnt out around 2018, because I'd said so much and I just felt like there was... Maybe I should have turned to writing then. I don't know. But definitely it's a different pace, a completely different thing, because you're not just talking to the camera as I am now. You're not just improvising. You're thinking about every sentence and every word. So that enables much more cogitation, much more redrafting, revising, refining. And I think that ends up being, as you say, this is something that seems to come with writing. It imposes a discipline, even when it's typing on a screen. It imposes a discipline on you, which I think is good, because it forces you to clarify your thoughts and what it is exactly that you're saying. So I agree about that. On streaming being ephemeral, yes, it is, but that doesn't need to be a bad thing. It's a bad thing if you're lazy about it. And this is why I did an essay basically telling people, here's how to do a good live stream interview. There are other types of live streams, but live stream interviews are my forte. And I said, here's how to do a good one. And the first thing is, it's not just a chat with a mate. It's got to be focused. Because if you don't have a focus, it's going to be a bit of a mess. Now, that can be good, but usually it won't be. It can be enjoyable, but usually it won't have lasting value. And I think if Millennial does have lasting value, one of the reasons that will be is that I try to maintain focus. And that means that each interview hopefully has a topic and a thrust, a narrative, and a structure, hopefully. That's the goal. And so it's not just a chat with a mate. It's something that addresses a tangible aspect of our life, our existence today, and therefore is hopefully valuable to people now, and hopefully will be valuable to people 100 years from now. Obviously, there are other things that they could watch as well that might address whatever. But this is one reason why I think this will be valuable, or could be valuable. Millennial as a diary, that's the final thing. Yes, I've said this previously this year. People can go back and see Semiogog in 2018, which was his first year, and each year subsequent, and compare where the person he was then with the person he is now, and so forth. It also is a sort of diary, a chronicle of our concerns as a community throughout those years, which certainly did evolve and probably will continue to evolve. So that's another reason why I think Millennial will be valuable, where other live streams won't be. But I don't say that with any sort of smugness. They can do the same thing too. I think with anything that you do, you should take it seriously or accept that it won't be taken seriously by other people in the future. And that's not the end of the world. It's fine to have fun. Just be aware that if you do, and if it's just fun, and if you don't take it seriously, then it will be trivial and it won't have lasting value. There we go.
Yeah, all I'd add is I am very much looking forward in terms of how this develops to this, your new idea of these banquets. I think that there's, in terms of it, just taking it from the perspective of historical documents, of trajectories and concerns and participants, and the variety of these concerns and how people were discussing things at the time. You know, there's like there's a guy I was into when I was younger, Max Stirner, who was among the young Hegelians, but who was this strange outside figure. And there's no portrait or photograph of him that survives. But he wrote this book called The Ego in Its Own. Anyway, the point is that there's a focus, Oliver. There are some cartoons that were drawn, you know, some quick little caricatures that were drawn, I think, by Engels, of some of these young Hegelians all hanging out, you know, in a pub or a coffee house or whatever, as they're all arguing their various points. And, you know, there's Stirner and, Johann Caspar Schmidt, I think was his real name. And there's a picture of him and he's captured there, but in a group with the rest of the people, standing off by himself, but there at the group. And I think the banquet aspect, holds out the promise of some of these, the dynamics of the people together rather than one-on-one, which is a very different kind of, environment. And it's going to bring out different aspects in the people. You know, it's one thing to have these group, live streams, which we're all familiar with, you know, where there'll be like four people on the panel or six or whatever. But I think the sort of, as the millennial has developed and sort of come into its own, you know, it's sort of set its own parameters over time that aren't arbitrary. They're kind of, this is where it falls. And to see the groups of people from these different regions come together. I'm very excited to look at how that unfolds. In particular, I just have to put it in there because I'm so interested. I understand from what you were saying with, Lichtmetz, that there will be this, you know, Germanosphere stream, and that you managed to get, you know, a Swiss German, Germans, and Austrians. And so for me, given that this is, you know, it is ultimately in some sense about nationalism or nationalisms, I'm just interested to hear what these different far-flung people from the German world think of each other. You know, how does a German think of an Austrian, to say nothing of the subgroups? And I have some sense of that. I have some sense of what the Germans are, how they think of themselves, some of how they view their different regions. But I don't know how Germans view Austrians, how Austrians view Germans. And I certainly have no fucking idea how either of them view the Swiss Germans or vice versa, you know. And so that in itself is something very interesting, because, you know, we're so bottled up in the Anglosphere, you know, nationalism discourse, that we don't get to see how the continental people and all the rest do their thing. So I think that's another great place in terms of historical documentation and this dynamic in play of how the different parties react and respond to each other.
Yeah, I've added that to my notes for that hangout. So I will ask them that. I appreciate all of what you just said there. I think it took me quite a few years to arrive at how I now do millennial interviews, one-to-one like this. And I think probably it will be the same with the banquets. I think it will become its own thing. Like it will be something that is part of millennial and is different from any other hangout that people do, but it might not. I don't know. it really depends how it's It depends on the possibilities, which I'm yet to see. I don't know. We'll just have to do it and find it. Just like with Millennial itself, with the interviews, I had to do it and refine it over time, learn how to do it properly, how to do it well. So, as I say, it's a new part of it. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. That's all I can say just now. I don't know what else to say about it.
A last little bit. I know you must be tired at the end of a day. What, the 11th or 12th day now?
Honestly, I'm not tired. But anyway, yes, go on.
Well, rock and roll then, goddammit. But there's, I have a quite a bit of experience now over the years with research for the corporate world. I left the domain of design and copywriting and advertising because it was becoming commodified. You know, you can crowdsource that shit for nothing. You know, you get a Romanian and a couple of Indians working on your logo for you, and you don't pay any of them, and you just pick one at the end and give them a pittance. So I said, screw that. And I got into branding and research. And in the course of that, I've had to travel to many different countries, many different times, and interview people. And I generally sit in the room with the person called the moderator. And I work with a guy who's really, really a good moderator. He knows how to bring the things out of the other person. Like you said, when you're interviewing someone, this is not a chat, you know. It requires a very specific skills. And you see that when you see someone who has to do interviews with many different people. And all those people have a different set of keys that you have to gain some sense of in relatively short order in order to unlock the discussion and make it fruitful. And so, I mean, I'm not just someone who has done interviews with people or done interviews of my own. I've seen professionals who are very good at it, and you have this talent. I suspect you had to earn it, but you will find that there is a difference. Sorry?
Thank you. It's kind of you to say that. And yes, I think I did have to earn it, but I'd have to watch early millennials to see how rusty, how amateurish they were. I can't really remember.
You certainly manage people well now too, in terms of keeping things online or focusing things and giving them room. But there are basically two domains here. This is what I wanted to get across. One of them we call IDIs. These are in-depth interviews, right? And for that type of research, most of the corporate people don't go for it because they want a large spread of numbers, right? Well, basically, I should say that it breaks out into what they call quant and qual, right? You have quantitative research where the statisticians get in, and they're talking about N equals, right? And then you have qualitative, and that's where my team and where I myself focused our attention, because we think that's where you can really get in there and see something. You know, we went to some fast food restaurant and these people are saying, you know, we're trying to figure out whether it's important to sit down at the table. Should they come up with something else that you can hand out the window in a bag and the car will drive away? Or should they focus on this idea of sitting down at a table and eating together? And there's this black guy sitting across from us wearing like a Lakers jersey and with big gold tooth. And he's like, no, in my family, you sit down and eat together. And we're all like, oh, okay. I'm not sure I believe that, you know, and manners at the table is the most important thing. And I'm like, okay. But throughout the group interview, he was really good. So we said, oh, what the hell? Let's do him for an IDI, right? You do a group interview in order to see who's most promising. And then you pull one from that group in order to go and do an in-depth interview. And that's just a method to get your best bang for your buck here and then use it as a way to vet people for the next stage. We went to his house. First thing we saw when we came in is perfectly clean, well-kept little duplex house. You know, his daughter comes home and is very polite and goes upstairs. And they're sitting on the little bar area between the kitchen and the dining room is a sculpture of the Last Supper, with all the little people set at the table around it. I'm like, oh, okay, this guy's not lying, right? You can call bullshit. You can delve deep and find out whether or not this is all but a bunch of superficial bullshit or, you know, whatever is underneath. So you've got the IDI, which you've clearly cut your teeth on. And you would, by the way, if you ever want to explore some way to make money on the side. I mean, a background with writing and research and the ability to interview large numbers of people you know, there is definitely a leftward tilt to the world of corporate research, but the abilities that you have can be monetized. Anyway, that's a separate thing. The group interviews, those are a very different world of managing personalities. Though I expect you probably have some experience with that from the simple fact that you've hosted people who are in competition or who dislike each other, you know, all in the same setting, but there's a very different dynamic and it takes a different set of skills to sort of unlock a group. You have to be almost like a referee, and you also have to, I don't know, some of it, I'm not good at it. I'm just going to tell, I'm terrible at it because I feel like I'm in a schoolyard and I just want to say, shut up, let him talk. Cause I like him and I don't like you.
But yeah, this is the thing. I don't know whether I'll be any good at it. It is a very different thing. The first year of Millennial, and this is why I'm doing it this year, because it's the 10th, and I wanted to honor the first year, which was very, it was a different format. It was hangouts. It was group hangouts. And actually open to the public, open hangouts. And I wanted to bring something of that back for the 10th year. So that's why I'm doing the banquets. And yeah, you're right that it is very different because you have to be a bit rude. I mean, I was very rude with people back then because there was no bloody mute button. You couldn't mute them. And it was chaos. That was the old Google Hangouts platform. And one of the problems with that was there was no way for the host to mute somebody, as I recall. You could only kick them out. You couldn't mute them. See, I was asking people to mute themselves and they just wouldn't. They just forget. They just wouldn't care to, whatever. So it was this constant cacophony of different things, people murmuring and interrupting someone else while they're speaking. It was a nightmare. I think there is the mute. You can do that on StreamYard, thank God. But also the people who will be taking part will be fairly seasoned streamers, so they'll know that kind of etiquette. Yeah, we'll just have to see how it goes. As I say, it might not happen again. It might just be this year and I realize I'm not good at it or it's not a good idea. It doesn't work. And I'll never do it again. Or it might become a regular thing. As I say, right now it's all up in the air. We're just going to have to see. But it will become very different from the one-to-one stuff. Another reason to do it is I've always felt that that's that bit in between Christmas and New Year is a different atmosphere, and it calls for a different atmosphere from these one-to-one interviews. It calls for more of a party atmosphere. I think that's what people, that's the mode people are in during that phase. It's when people are going to parties and get-togethers and meals and stuff. So to emulate that on here, you can't just have intense one-to-one interviews. It's got to be something else. So more social. So that's another reason to do it. And so, as I say, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, it's more reflective in terms, I mean, and you've taken that, well, I mean, first off, it's on brand, right? Millennial woes, right? This reflection, deep reflection, consideration of what's happened. Why did it happen? You know, where are we now? And so you have these sets of questions that you ask, you know, how has the year been for you? Would you like to talk about what has happened in 2024 or 2023 and the rest? And so there's this reflection about the year that has passed, and that's fitting with the solstice where, you know, we're roughly in this period where it's the shortest day, the coldest weather, in the depths, right? But then you have the idea of the outgoing old man of the previous year and the incoming baby of the new year. As you say, this idea of celebration, because we've crossed it, you know, we've gone through the narrow, cold spot, right? And now the vistas open up before us again with this promise of spring eventually, you know, the days are slowly getting longer. And so perhaps some aspect of a forward focus, you know, the Janus face is looking backwards at the previous year with the individual interviews, which are more reflective. And perhaps, you know, you're looking in the other direction with the baby new year and the celebration. I mean, it, it certainly fits, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. That's a good idea. That is a very interesting idea. I might go with that. All right. Okay, well, let's end this one here, because I think this has been a really nice conversation. Quite a lot of people have said it's been very thought-provoking. All right. I don't want to hurry you. Is there anything else that you'd want to say about this?
No, just thanks very much for having me on. I looked at the number of years I've been coming here and doing these, and I don't have these thoughts fully formed, but when I was talking to you about this whole thing of I haven't gone back and looked at the sequence of my interviews, you know, the background's going to disappear. The background will change behind me. You know, I think probably the first one I was maybe upstairs at my old place and then downstairs at my old place. And now I'm out in the woods. Now I'm married. Before I was single and miserable, you know.
Do you want to see us the screenshot of from that first millennial 2018?
The first one?
All right. Okay, here we go.
Sweet God in heaven. Well, I have two black eyebrows at that point anyway, which is something, instead of looking like a dog that's like had one half of its head bleached. yes. That was downstairs. I had just moved into the downstairs, and those horrible old bookshelves were there. Yeah, that was shortly before my escape. Yeah. Woof. Once upon a time. So yeah, for me, that's just the last thing I wanted to say, is that it's been a, you know, what a long, strange trip it's been. Yes.
yeah, it has, hasn't it? It's nice that it's recorded. It's nice that it's there and we can refer to it.
So thank you very much for having me again. It's a great pleasure to be involved and to see this all unfold. Good luck with the banquets. Good luck with the writing. And yes, sir.
All right. You are invited to the American banquet, aren't you?
Yes, as I recall, and I will be there with bells on. Okay. I can't promise that I won't bring a beverage with me this time.
That might be appropriate, though. Don't worry.
Right on.
All right. Okay. Well, all right, on that note, tomorrow I will be back with another four interviews, and that's with Frode Midjord, and then Arvol, and then hopefully Mouthy Buddha, although I'm not sure because he hasn't replied. I'm not sure if he understands. I don't know what's going on there. And then Josh Neal. And then there will be the Christmas card stream. So that's a unique stream each millennial. I've done it twice, so this will be the third time. And it usually goes well. There have been quite a lot of cards. Not as many as last year, as I recall, but still quite a few. So and it is probably, it's certainly too late now to post a card for it to appear in the stream. But I will end with that, the P.O. Box address on screen so that people can see that. I'll still get it, but it won't appear on the stream tomorrow night. So that will be five streams tomorrow, four interviews, and then the cards. All right. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy that. I hope you've enjoyed this evening of four interviews. I will leave you with that. But in the meantime, Semyo Gog, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all.
And to you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial Amount.
I just realized that I forgot the super chats. Semiogog, I'm so sorry. I just realized it.
No problem.
Sorry, everyone. Okay, I really do apologize. Alt White said, happy holidays to everyone. Thank you very much. Bob Davis said, "Tribe up, white man." That's a message that a lot of people have been intoning over the last few years, and I think it's as salient as ever. And then Alt-White said, "Such a thought-provoking conversation." That was an hour ago he said that as well. "Thank you, Woz and Semiogog, for getting my brain humming." And then he also posted 2 minutes ago, posted a very generous super chat and said, been a wild ride tonight, Woz. You're the best." Well, thank you very much, Alt-White. And thank you for all of these super chats that you've been sending in. I really do appreciate it. So, yeah, thank you. And then also there were a few, five actually, from other avenues. Nick said, "I've been watching Millennial for 7 years now, and I love this little gathering of voices. Been a decent year, so I want to help contribute. My only request is that you attempt to speak in an American accent for at least a little bit. Merry Christmas." Well, I do a terrible American accent. I can say, "Oh my God," or what's the "Do you see my motor? Ain't she a beaut?" Or something like that. It's like Crichton from Red Dwarf, really, more than an actual American accent. It's a terrible accent.
The only one I can do that's Scottish, I just say, my wife does it. For some reason, my wife thinks you're better than sliced bread. She always asks me to do it, and I go, "Hello."
Everyone says this.
"Hello."
Yeah. I think this is one of those things that it becomes a trope, but I only did it in the first place. It just seemed like the natural way to open a video. So I would say, "Hello." And then thank you for, at the end, I'd say, "Thank you for watching." And that was it. And it just seemed, it was like with the dressing gown. I know, I understand why it became a thing, why people find it funny and all that. But it really was just how I dress. So it was just natural to, because I was basically the unemployed, not basement dweller, but certainly living in my bedroom at my dad's house. So it was just, there was no reason to dress up. You know, there was no reason. It was just how I was. So it became,
you just have to own it.
Yeah, exactly. I've just got to own it. Okay. And then Stephen said, "It's been a lovely chat, Woz." And then he makes a humorous comment, which I won't read out, but thank you, Stephen. And then he also said, "Yeah, as an Appalachian of pure British background, I get a little irritated when I hear folks, especially those of British, Irish, French, and others mixed background, calling me a mutt with no ethnic identity. But yeah, inbred jokes are fine. Ha ha." Okay. All right. And he also says, "As a Northwestern European, I'd like to congratulate Semiogog on his entrance to whiteness. However, as a regular visitor to England and Spain both, I'm sorry to report that meds are way more fun." This is something I've got to say, that Italians, when I've been to Italy quite a few times, I've never actually been to Spain or Portugal, but I've been to Italy quite a few times, and they are very happy and social and warm and just laid back, just very laid back. It's a very different thing from Northern Europe. And then finally, Stephen said, "On a serious note, some of my favorite chill days were years ago playing my guitars and listening to Tim and Oliver talk about maps for sell and intrigue and all kinds of interesting geopolitics. Props to Semiogog for years of excellence."
Thank you very much. Thanks very much indeed.
Very nice comments. So sorry, everyone, that I nearly forgot the super chats. That's terrible. It's one of the disciplines you've got to adopt each year. Yeah, these things you've got to bear in mind. Okay. With that said, everyone,
it's going to be a good Easter egg at the end. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a fun wee Easter egg. All right. Good night, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye for now. Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.